Hello, everyone. Welcome to One More Prime, the Transformers Watch Along. I am Mike Schwartz, a man who needs to go shovel after he records this intro. Winter is finally here. I am joined by my kids, Emma and Elsa.
Hello.
Hi.
Who, hey, why don't you go out and shovel, and I'll have some hot cocoa. Change it up a bit, huh?
I do sometimes.
We are watching Hoist Goes Hollywood, episode 38 of season 2. I think, based on our guest star, we should quickly cover an interesting chapter in Transformers toy history, Star Wars Transformers. Debuting in 2005, Star Wars Transformers had 7 waves of toys, about 20 figures. In 2008, the line was rebranded into Transformers Crossovers, which included 9 waves of Marvel Transformers. This is all pre-Disney buyout, kids. A lot of the Star Wars figures released at this time were repackages or redecos, but there were some new toys, including Yoda transforming into a Republic attack shuttle. The line reverted back to Star Wars Transformers in 2011 once the Marvel line concluded. It would run one more year, producing a line of smaller scale toys. Let's not touch on the merits of the toys themselves. It could not have been an easy task designing such famous spaceships to transform when they were never intended to transform in the first place, let alone get them to look like their famous pilots. Hey, you try to get an Imperial shuttle to transform into Emperor Palpatine. Come on, do it. Still, this era is interesting to say the least, and since I wasn't really paying that much attention to Transformers at the time, I can't believe they made so many. I may have to look for that General Grievous wheel bike and Ghost Rider motorcycle. Those aren't half bad. Today's guest is Alex Robinson. Alex is a writer and artist. All his books, including the classic box office Poison, are available at TopShelfComics.com. Alex is also a podcaster, co-hosting the shows Alphabetical, Godfather Minute, and our personal favorite at the Schwartz household, Star Wars Minute.
Minute.
Their new season covering The Rise of Skywalker is coming soon. Hopefully. Come on, hurry up. Written by Earl Kress and airing on November 21st, 1985, this is Hoist Goes Hollywood. All right, everybody, joining us is Alex Robinson. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Hello there, happy to be here.
So we are fans of Star Wars Minute. It's 2023, and by my calculation, that means you guys have been going for 10 years now?
Yes. We're about to start our 11th movie, The Rise of Skywalker, this year.
Yeah, possibly the last one for now. I mean,
we'll see.
Seems whenever they announce something, then they announce that they're putting it on hold.
Yeah, I don't believe anything until I see a trailer for stuff these days.
Yeah, which had me bummed out about Rogue Squadron, because that's the kind of movie I want to see. I tend to watch supercuts of Return of the Jedi space battles and stuff. It's like, I would love to have something like that, but
I guess Rogue One's space battle was that'll have to satisfy you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Real quick with Star Wars Minute, if you could handcraft a Star Wars movie to analyze 1 minute at a time, you know, with everything you've done so far, what would that be? Would it be space battles? Would it be, you know, we're in the Disney Plus era, so you have more serialized television shows.
Andor. Yeah. Ooh, that's amazing.
Andor is so good.
Yeah, we're big fans.
You know, I don't necessarily think it's a quality movie, but I would actually say Rise of Skywalker. Just because it's the things that make it kind of, for me, not good as a movie. Like, I feel like it's overstuffed with concepts and things and characters, mm-hmm. and it kind of has a real manic pace where, like, we go to like 20 different locations and every 5 minutes we're going to a new planet and so that's great when you're doing a minute by minute podcast, because there's always new stuff to talk about and new characters and new scenes. Like, that's the ideal, the things that make a good movie don't necessarily make it the best minute by minute movie, and vice versa. So
I agree. Yeah. Especially Rise of Skywalker. Right. I just pull up the first 5 minutes and they go so many places. Like,
yeah.
So unlike kind of how things slowly unfold in a Star Wars movie, and here it's just bouncing. I remember in the theater, it's like, whoa, what is going on? There's no room to breathe.
Yeah, that's why I didn't like it. There were so many things going on that I do not remember what that movie was about because there were so many characters and so many things to keep track of.
Yeah, it's hard to actually remember. Like, I there's huge chunks of the movie. It's like, I don't even remember watching this. I don't remember that it happened.
Bam, new planet. Bam, new character. Bam, old planet. Bam, hey, it's Lando. Bam, we're back to a new planet.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I can't wait for Rise of Skywalker because with all the guests you have on, I can't wait to hear if people go back to it very much, I guess.
It'll be interesting because also my co-host, Peter E. Taylor, likes the movie.
So, that's so weird.
So we might very well fall into a bickering Siskel and Ebert type dynamic.
Do we know when that's coming out yet? Have you guys set a date yet or not quite?
There is no firm date set as of yet.
Okay. Getting off of Star Wars, were you aware that for several years there was a Star Wars Transformers toy line?
I think I had seen that. I used to be a bit of a toy collector, and I stopped, but I still kind of monitor what's going on. And yeah, they were pretty, pretty funny looking.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a time, newly married, having kids, so I wasn't really, I would go down the toy aisles in Target, but I wasn't really buying anything, I wasn't paying that much attention, but I would see these things, and looking at it now, it's like, I can't believe how many they made. They go quite deep. I wouldn't envy the toy designer to, you know, take some of these vehicles and not just get them to transform, but to get them to look like the character that they're associated with.
I mean, just slap a Kit Fisto head on a Jedi Starfighter and bam, you're good.
Yeah, you could get some redecos that way. Just switching
so
out
many
the heads
redecos
on those.
Of yeah. Just the Jedi Starfighter.
Well, they just so put a different many. Head.
But they made several General Grievous toys and a lot of Darth Vader ones. They had Darth Vader as the Death Star. I think that was like a... Was that a giant-sized one?
Now yeah. That looks cool.
Yeah, that's not too bad. And then they had the Millennium Falcon that was... It came apart in two pieces, and one piece was Han, and one piece was Chewie.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's nice. Did they do another one with Lando and L3?
No. The line ended in 2012. The big ones were done in 2012, and then 2011, and then in 2012 they had a smaller scale line.
Does Disney own the Transformers?
No, they're still Hasbro.
It's been Hasbro for a while.
Disney doesn't own Hasbro?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, well, Hasbro just laid off 15% of their global workforce today, so ugh. Anything is possible nowadays. Real quick, Alex, you're also an artist, a comic creator. I'm actually reading Box Office Poison for the first time right now and greatly enjoying it.
Does it hold up? I guess you never read it the first time, but you're just now almost 30 years old, or 20, 25 years old, so...
Oh my gosh, wow.
I'm not responsible for things that have aged poorly.
No, I'm not getting any of that. In fact, I'm reading it off of the Hoopla app, so it's the whole collection, which is about, it's like 600 pages. I think I'm about 200 pages into it.
Hmm.
Yeah, no, I really like the stuff where they're covering the old comic book creator and kind of going through, you know, like the kind of the Jack Kirby and Siegel and Schuster kind of getting their getting screwed over by the studios while their creations are infinitely successful. I think that holds up very well.
Well, good. Well, it's sad, but good.
Yeah, it's very sad. When I turn the page and it's just kind of a splash page of him looking sad in the mirror, it's like, oh man, like those are still very effective. You're working pretty much digital now, correct?
Yes, I picked up the Procreate on the iPad and never looked back.
How has that opened up your work process? How is it different than working pen to paper?
Well, the thing I like about it is that you can really work on something until you get it exactly how you want, rather than I put the line down on the paper. That's it. I probably undo half of the lines I do on the iPad in a quest to make it look right. And so for the first time in my life, I'm able to look at my art and go, okay, that's pretty good. Because usually I'm just like, ugh, all I can see are all the mistakes and stuff. But now that happens less. So thank you, Steve Jobs, for making me be able to tolerate looking at my own art.
Do you ever export the video of like the progress, how it records all of your lines?
Yeah, I'll sometimes put it on my Insta or something like that. But it is fascinating to watch.
How you draw something and then it disappears, and then you redraw, yeah. Disappears, redraw. Have you done a lot of comics work lately? Because you're doing a lot of more pinups and art that corresponds with the show and t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah, in addition to my, being able to undo as much as I like, I find that the thing about comics is you have to be able to go fast, and I feel more like spending a lot of time doing one very well done drawing rather than the kind of faster pace that comics were playing. And also I get sick of drawing the same things over and over and over again, which is something in comics you have to, that's a skill you have to have to be able to do. It's an undervalued skill, is the discipline it takes to draw the same characters over and over and over again.
And keep them looking the same.
And just not get sick to death of drawing them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think I got to that point where I'm just like, you know, like I'm drawing a character and my inclination is to give them like a really complicated, detailed, like costume or outfit or whatever. I'm like, you can't do that in comics because then you're stuck with, you have the Jack of Hearts problem where now you have to draw that character's complicated costume over and over and over again. And
George Perez seemed to relish that. He would draw every curl in the Scarlet Witch's hair, and yeah, like characters like Jack of Hearts and everything. It's like, yeah, that's a different breed. I'm drawing a graphic novel that's years in the works. It's a nighttime project. And I have a lot of very complicated vehicles, and it took me maybe until last year.
Oh my gosh!
Where I tried drawing them freehand, and I gave up. But what I did is, speaking of iPads, I found an app where I kind of taught myself how to build things in 3D. You know, very just, you know, just bashing it together, just smooshing shapes until I could get it.
Bare bones. Yeah.
Yes, but it was enough where I could get it and compose the scene to how I wanted, and then kind of take those models and then draw over them. So I'm still drawing them. I'm still adding details that aren't in the 3D model, but it saved so much hair pulling and just the agony of drawing it, so that now it's actually kind of fun to do it. When I tend to design vehicles, I design them impossibly, where it's like, well, if I move it at this angle, these lines make no sense at all. Like these shapes just don't go together. So that saved my life, truly.
Yeah, it's a real, it really is a revolutionary tool.
Yeah. And then I look at something like Transformers, which, you know, giant robots into vehicles. It's like, how did they do that? This episode that we're going to cover, Hoist Goes Hollywood, I think there weren't a ton of animation errors. There were a few missing faceplates, but...
And yeah, maybe a layering issue? I'm not sure what the heck was up with that. We'll get to it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into Hoist Goes Hollywood. Now, Alex, are you very familiar with Transformers? Did you watch that growing up? Or
I am very unfamiliar with the Transformers. In fact, I think this might only be the second episode I've ever seen.
Excellent. This is our favorite type of guests.
Okay, good.
No, it's great because I love seeing outsider eyes into something like this, because this is a very long season. There's 49 episodes in season
Sheesh.
Two. Yeah. Yeah, so, and we're nearing the end, and this is definitely where the writers are just coming up with very crazy plots. So
they're not bad.
No, they're not bad. Like this one is Transformers becoming movie stars.
We had a couple love stories in a row.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry that you missed. Yeah, there were two episodes almost next to each other where Transformers fell in love. One with a human girl and one with an alien woman who turned into a mermaid. Or she could shapeshift into a mermaid or a human or a robot or a canoe.
What? So there's never any intra-Transformers relationships? It's not like one Transformer falls in love with another Transformer?
That's more in the comics, wish. I think. Yeah.
No, there was the search for Alpha Trion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Optimus Prime, who's not in this episode, they do kind of have a relationship with Alita One, who is a female Transformer. Yeah. Let's get into Hoist Goes Hollywood. So we begin on the edge of a mountain, and we see our two of our human characters. This is Spike and his girlfriend, Carly. Alex, Carly is canonically an MIT graduate, and Spike is about 16 years old, so we're not quite sure how that works out.
We're not going to talk about that. Anyway,
she's just smart.
Or maybe she skipped a couple grades.
Yeah.
And they're the same age.
Let's just say that.
She at least is old enough for a driver's license, because she has this cool purple Corvette in a previous episode.
Yeah, and that got phased into thin air, so.
Oh, yeah. But they're driving in Hoist, which we don't really see very often. He's not one of the more front and center Transformers. But they stumble into two cars racing around the cliff. Yeah, Spike and Carly and Hoist wander onto an active filming set of a movie.
Which is kind of weird, because I think they would know that there might be filming in the area.
I would think
so. Or there'd be like a sign.
But this is also the 80s, so who
That's
knows what
true.
The safety standards were with stuntmen.
It does seem weird that some production assistant probably got fired over letting them just drive into the shot.
I think so, but as we meet this director,
he's insane. I don't know what movie.
Crazy.
Yeah, what movie is this?
What movie is this? First, you have a car chase, then you have a bunch of crashes, and then it turns into a space movie.
Well, they yeah, scrapped
that
the
does
idea.
Sound
they
pretty standard.
This director's insane.
Never has a name. I even checked on TF Wiki, and he's just labeled as director.
Cheap director. How's that?
Yeah, but the two cars that were involved in the stunt, one lands on top of each other. Muppet movie style, which this was not supposed to happen too. They go flying off the cliff, and there's this one shot where the entire crew is running toward it, and the director's standing there with his hand on his mouth, and he doesn't move. And I know he runs away.
I'm not gonna get sued for this.
Yeah,
not again.
Judging by his character, I bet he has.
But Hoist, who is a tow truck, he climbs down the mountainside and just narrowly rescues the stunt drivers as the cars plummet to a very fiery explosion.
Okay, first his hand was huge, then it's small enough to hold a human hand, and then he's back to being giant. What's up with that?
Yeah.
That has to be a problem throughout the series, because there's even in this one episode, there's probably a dozen times where, like, there's one scene where they look up and standing in the doorway is, what's the bad guy's name? Megatron.
Yep.
Like, he's standing in the doorway like he's a human, like he's like 6 feet tall, and then they walk up to him and then suddenly he's like 20 feet tall. It's like some kind of weird, yeah. I think it's whatever size they need to be for a given situation is what's, is there any consistency in it?
No.
Yes. Well, there's so many scaling issues throughout the entire series that it's kind of a normal thing.
Yeah, generally the Transformers, they tend to, I think they're supposed to be about three stories tall. But then when you need to get them into a building or in a doorway, yes, this is a consistent problem. It's probably best just to ignore it, to enjoy the series going forward. There's jets that become the size of like a space shuttle that, you know, 10 of them can fit in at once.
There's a train that becomes the size of a space shuttle that becomes the size of a normal robot, which is shorter than Megatron.
So, yeah, you mentioned that it was good having a newbie on like me, but I feel like the questions I'm going to ask are all questions that, like, for instance, I've noticed that a lot of the Transformers all kind of have different accents and stuff like that.
Yes.
Like, are they raised in different places? Like, if you go to one of their hometown, do they all sound like they have that same accent? Do they all live, how are they created in like a factory? Or are they, how are they made? What's their origins?
That's a lot of stuff to go through.
That's what I mean. So we don't have to go into it now, but I can look it up on the Wikipedia, but just weird.
Yeah, almost every iteration has a different creation myth, I guess.
Yeah.
Because as this cartoon was going, there was a Marvel comic going on simultaneously. And then there's also a Marvel UK comic, which they split off continuity wise. And then there was a Japanese manga going on.
And then once the series ended, the Japanese anime chose not to do that and kept going for like four more series.
Right. Then after Marvel stopped, and there was Dreamwave, and then IDW, which they just finished. Oh, they had the rights for over 10 years, and they had a whole different way that they're created. So
in multiple phases.
In terms of the cartoon, they get into that more in season 3, but we haven't covered that. And actually, I have not watched that season in a very long time, so it will be mostly new to me as well.
But yeah, accent-wise, I don't know.
Just whatever they're programmed.
Easy shorthand. Like, well, this guy's smart, oh, sure. He has an English accent.
It definitely gives them character.
Yeah.
Like, if you know, like, their accent gives a lot of personality to them.
I believe it.
Getting back to the episode, the director meets Hoist. This is the running gag in the episode where he calls him Moist.
Moist. Hoist isn't exactly a common name either.
Yeah.
So he offers him a job. And then Spike and Carly meet the two actors of this movie. We see Harold Edsel and Karen Fishhook.
I don't recognize those references.
When Emmett, Elsa.
When Emmett told me,
Harrison
I was like
Ford and Carrie Fisher. Karen Fishhook.
I didn't get it first either.
Then we'll see in other shots that Carrie Fishhook has the Princess Leia buns.
All right. One thing that kind of surprised me, and I don't know, again, this might be something that is covered in other episodes, but the movie crew and director and so on seem to take it really in stride that there are giant robots walking around and like they're like, hey, let's just put them in the movie. Not, oh, my gosh, what on earth is this? And running away in terror. They're just kind of like, cool. Giant robots that talk.
It's been a couple of years since they've been on Earth. They're fine.
So everyone knows them about? Like, everyone on Earth is familiar with, just like, knows about the existence of the Transformers?
It seems to be. There have been episodes where, like, all the great scientists of the world invite the Transformers to help solve a problem, or, you know, the public has a parade to celebrate the Autobots. Yeah, it seems to be that they're known.
And so that, because that would seem like it would, to people know that they are aliens from another world?
That
I don't
know.
Or they just think that they are locally, that they're created like the MIT labs and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's established.
Carly, is this your pet robot?
Because I mean, that would transform society if we knew there were giant alien robots from another planet coming to visit us and fight each other, and that for some reason they look like human vehicles, that would be really weird.
There was one storyline where they tried to bring Cybertron, their home planet, to Earth.
Because they're homesick.
Well, also to enslave humanity to kind of rebuild it.
But they're also homesick.
Yeah. Aww.
Why are you focusing on the negative part of it?
So now we go to the Decepticons, where we see the jet. This is Dirge, and he's carrying a very large device, which we will find out more about later. And he coincidentally crashes into the studio set, which is kind of like a jungle theme. He crashes into a pond. And Megatron's very upset about that, because this device must remain secret. Megatron orders Thrust, Ramjet, and Astrotrain to go retrieve the cargo.
See, this is what we were talking about, Astrotrain. That complex guy.
Yeah, he turns into a space shuttle or a train.
Who could have guessed?
Why does he get two things?
Well, it Toys. Was later in the series, and they needed new gimmicks, so they introduced the triple changers.
Wow. So,
which were actually planned toys for another toy line in Japan, because that's where they got a bunch of the stuff. Like Microchange and Diaclone became one toy line in the Transformers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they bought toys that were already being sold in Japan and kind of repurposed them. In Japan, I didn't think they had a story. They were just kind of transforming robots. And it was Bob Budiansky and Denny O'Neill. They kind of invented the entire Transformers mythos in a weekend while they were working for Marvel Comics because they had a partnership. So Hoist arrives on the set of Major Pictures. That's the name of the studio.
Wow, how original.
And when he drives up, it seems the director forgets about him. He's sitting in his chair. He's like, oh, yeah, the giant robot. Go grab a donut and a coffee, and we'll call you when we need you.
Donut?
Then the other Autobots show up. We see, who is this? Who do we have here?
Trax.
Trax.
He's flashy as ever.
Warpath. We have Sunstreaker.
And Powerglide.
Yeah, Powerglide. Yeah. And they all seem to be jealous. They want to be part of the fun as well.
But how'd they find out?
Yeah, because they seem to show up purely to get into the movie, not to recover this device, this thing that the Decepticons seem to be interested in.
They don't know about that yet.
Yeah, they don't know.
Yeah.
Now, Powerglide, he's the red jet, and he does say, you know, here's some Oscar-winning material. And that made me research, have the Transformers ever won an Oscar? Because, you know, there's been six motion pictures. Well, seven. There was the animated one in the 80s, and then there were five Michael Bay live-action movies, and then the Bumblebee movie.
Soon to be eight this
year. Yeah,
so
Rise excited. Of the Beast comes out in the summer. So they have been nominated. The first Transformers movie and then the third one, they were nominated for sound editing, sound mixing, and visual effects. And Revenge of the Fallen, that was the second movie that was nominated for sound mixing as well. But also, they did pick up a few Golden Raspberry Awards.
What are those?
Oh, wow.
The Golden Raspberries is... Who were they created by? Were they... Is it like the editor of Spy Magazine or something? Do you know, Alex?
That does sound plausible. I don't know for sure. People can Google it. Yeah.
A while ago, like whenever it was the Academy Award nominations come out, then he would release a list of like the worst movies of the year. Transformers did pick up a few. Revenge of the Fallen won for Worst Picture. Michael Bay won for Worst Director for the second and fourth movie.
Yay!
And the only actor to win was Kelsey Grammer. He was in the fourth movie, Age of Extinction. He was the bad guy, actually. And he also gets shot point blank by Optimus Prime.
Age of Extinction. Okay, got it. Thanks.
All the Autobots are hired as kind of stunt vehicles for whatever movie this is. And we see these montage of shots where it's just basically an Autobot crashing into a building or Powerglide. A jet flies right into the front of a store. Harold Edsel climb out of the wreckage, and then Carrie Fishhook goes up and kisses him. Yeah, this movie seems to have no script, because then the director finds Dirge, who's in the pond with the device, and he's like, hey, we can use this.
Build a bridge over it.
It seems to me, once you have giant robots that can transform into things, why don't you just make that the movie? Just say, hey, you know what? You guys just fight each other for a couple of minutes, and we'll just film that and release it as part of the movie, you know?
After the montage of the Autobots being stunt vehicles, now they're upset. They want to be real actors. And the director tells him to go have a bagel and coffee.
Bagel?
Is it only round? It's weird that it's bagels and donuts, both of which are shaped the same.
So you have bagels and then attractive bagels.
Now we go to commercial one, where the Decepticons arrive, and Astroterrain is, he kind of lowers down these hooks to pick up Dirge and the device. And when we come back, the director seems to like what's going on, and he orders to roll camera. The Thrust shoots the camera.
All right, I'm going to have to ask everyone here, what do you think the original plot of this movie was?
Just cars blowing up, and then this man walking out of the explosion and then getting kissed.
Yeah, it seems to be like he was always rescuing her from, didn't they say, like, the gangsters or the thugs?
I mean, there was that car crash at the beginning.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like some kind of Burt Reynolds movie from the 80s or something. It's a lot of car chases, saving the girl, and like finding their way into another car chase. I'm not sure the writers of this episode knew what it was. So then we get back to the Decepticons' underwater headquarters, where they do retrieve this device, and it doesn't seem to be working, which makes Megatron angry, and he takes out his frustrations on Starscream, which he does the entire episode. He's always punching him, picking him up.
It's just not their normal working dynamic?
It is. No, it is. But he's particularly cruel in this one, to the point where he just like rips out the wiring in his chest.
And he is not seen in the next episode?
Yeah, I don't think he's in the next episode.
The hospital.
Funny thing, the Decepticons don't really have a medic.
No. Yeah, the Autobots have Ratchet, and sometimes Wheeljack helps patch him up, but...
And then there's Grapple and Hoist, just the engineers.
Got a lot of smart people. And then the Decepticons who just kind of do their best, but they don't really care.
Yeah, there's a lot of bickering and infighting, so maybe the Decepticons just repair themselves.
Well, walk
no
it
one's
off.
Looking. But the device shorts out. It's not working. But now we switch to Megatron wanting the footage.
I think he says if the Autobots see it, then they'll know what they're up to. Because I thought that was very weird that they thought the Autobots would see footage from
yeah,
the
this
movie.
Suggests that the Autobots, like, they would wait until the movie's out in theaters. I'd like to see that episode.
I'd like to see just them watching a movie for the entire episode. Just the backs of their heads, and then you can see the screen.
Would the projector also be a robot?
Maybe they have a favorite theater where they just kind of take out maybe 10 rows.
It's a drive-in theater, Dad. Come on.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Right in front of you. You didn't see it.
Then we go back to Major Studios, and the director has, I guess that's his producer. The guy that looks like Clark Kent. And then Harry and Harold, and they're reviewing the footage. And the director loves the footage to the point where he's willing to rewrite the entire script.
I love it. Let's just scrap everything else and do it again. Like...
Which, like, breaks the soul of Harold Edsel. He's like, new script. Oh, no. And he weeps into his hands. He has to be consoled by Carrie Fishhook. All the Autobots, they've been rehired, and now they're actors. And they're sitting in their director's chairs.
At least Hoist is still Hoist.
Well, here's the thing. If you look, Trax, his name is misspelled as Trux.
On the back of his director chair.
Which makes me think this is a running gag of the director calling Hoist Moist, but Hoist chair is spelled correctly.
What?
I was expecting them all to have some sort of little imperfection.
I know, like Sunstreaker could be like swimsuit or like sunscreen. Warpath could be like Warpooth.
I thought that's what they were going for, but I think that was just a mistake. Because, you know, these are Japanese studios for the most part, and whenever they have billboards, they tend to be kind of nonsense phrases and
banana
stuff. Yeah, like buildings will just say banana or beefcake.
No, so, no hate, but this is kind of funny.
No.
There's even a warehouse that has two L's in a close.
Yeah, so I was just gonna point that out.
So yeah, I think this was just a spelling error rather than a running gag of the director mispronouncing or misspelling the Autobots' names. But now the movie has turned into a sci-fi adventure where they have to wear alien masks, which are very, very goofy looking.
Can I just rewind for 1 second? That
yes,
scene where they're all sitting on the director's chairs?
Mm-hmm.
Did they build these direct... Did they have... It's so weird that they made chairs for these giant robots.
Well, they can build a bridge very quickly, so maybe...
What kind of PVC pipes are you using?
Anyway, I just thought that it was weird that they went through the trouble of building chairs for these giant robots, most of which can turn into vehicles anyway and are used to just kind of sitting on the ground. So anyway, moving on.
They're the stars. Got to keep them comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, then also they've built this this sci-fi set.
I know the sets, the impeccable timing of these people. You have the bridge, the chairs, the set, and soon to be the rocket.
Yeah, it's a very good production crew. And the cool thing with this background is they could have used a background of Cybertron, which we've seen in previous episodes, but this one looks pretty different. Pretty cool sci-fi background. But the Autobots who wanted to be actors, they're not very good. They're walking single file in kind of like a, I don't know, Frankenstein pose, almost chasing the heroes now.
Maybe they're good actors. That's just the director saying that, telling them what to do.
Yeah.
Slower, less intense.
That he's just like, fall down when they're not falling down. But he did fire his gun. Like, it's special effects. We'll draw them in later. So it's like, okay. And he just falls over so hard.
I do like how this episode does try to get like the process of filmmaking
here
and
there. Yeah.
To the point where now we get into how film editing works and work prints, which factor very heavily into the rest of the episode.
Very inside baseball.
It is, yeah. Spike and Carly walk into an editor's booth, meet an editor. She's looking for some missing reels of film. And while she's doing that, Carly looks up and one of the reels is in black and white. She's like, why is this in black and white? I thought you filmed in color. It's like, oh, no. That's a work print. Work prints are in black and white so that we can edit and move around scenes and we don't mess up the master. It seems that the Decepticons have stolen the work print, but not the actual film. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, the original is still in the vault.
Yeah, Emma, here's your studio with the two L's. Lowe's.
Wow, they're really emphasizing it to be closed, aren't they?
But enough for the Decepticons to be in there, and you know, Megatron's holding up the film to the light. Soundwave tells him that it's just the warp print. Which,
huh. I thought he would be an audio specialist.
And this earns all of Megatron's rage. Megatron throws Starscream. Yeah, this is where he rips his chest and he makes a really, you know, like his voice box is slowing down like an old tape recorder. And Megatron wants that footage. We go back to the film set. Now we have this kind of spaceship, sort of like a Flash Gordon type looking thing. And
yeah, but what was Harold Edsel's movie name? It was like Dash something.
Oh, it's Dash Jordan.
I thought it was a Dash Rendar reference. Before Dash Rendar.
But in my research, the Dash Jordan actually is referenced in a G.I. Joe episode. I guess he's referenced to be appearing at a sci-fi convention.
So this movie went through.
I guess, yeah. But as the Autobots are filming this, and there are supposed to be planned explosions, but Rumble... Now, Alex, Rumble is... This is his proper size. He can fit through a doorway. He's a little taller than a human.
He's kind of shrimpy by Transformers.
Yeah, standards. Because he turns into a cassette that goes into Soundwave.
Uh-huh. And then they both shrink.
Yeah, so he's naturally smaller, so he can go through the doorway. And he puts an actual bomb at the front of the...
Does Megatron is the king of the bad guys?
Yes.
King of the bad guys, what a title.
Does he... I know he turns into a gun, right? Because guns are evil. Does he turn into a... Does a human ever fire Megatron? Does he ever hold him like he's a gun and fire him? You know what I
mean? In the comics, yes.
Yeah. He jumps into usually Soundwave or sometimes Starscream's hand. So he gets fired by other Decepticons.
But even then, like you said, the scaling is weird because...
Yeah, he shrinks down.
Okay. All right.
But then we go into commercial 2 where Rumble's bomb goes off and it seems that the Autobots are all dead. They climb out of the wreckage without their masks.
Yeah, those disintegrated. Cheap paper mache.
They burned up.
The producer, I assume, says, this is no accident. Sounds like he did it.
Oh, yeah.
This
was
no accident.
Yeah, well, they wanted to like investigate it. And then like, no. This is good stuff. Okay, so then... The Autobots climb out. They seem to be okay. And then Carly and Spike are back in the screening room. They have free reign of the studio. And they're watching the footage. And then Soundwave bursts through the screen. Sweetums style at the end of the Muppet movie. I'm referencing the Muppet movie again.
It's a good movie. Come on.
Has anyone ever done a Muppet movie minute?
Ooh, you know what? I definitely remember it being mentioned, but I don't know if anyone ever followed through with it. It's a good question.
I'm not claiming it. I'm not. We're just trying to get through this season.
You viewers out there, do you want to do a Muppet minute? Well, go ahead. We're not taking it.
Yeah. They evade Soundwave, but then Megatron heads them off, and then Carly throws the film reel at Megatron.
Well, he's 6 feet tall.
Yeah. But that was the old switcheroo, because Carly had the real reel under her sweater. But then Soundwave catches them, and then they go running off into a jungle set, and they're immediately lost. It's like, oh, come on. And they're also out of breath.
How big is this set? How far do they run? How big is this set? And
huge studio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Carly and Spike seem to be dumbfounded by the movie making process. They find a control box just sitting there which operates these robotic dinosaurs, which start to move around and then rumble.
Character trait. Absolutely stupid.
Yeah. And he thinks that they're the Dinobots. Now, yeah, Alex, there are a set of Autobots that transform into dinosaurs.
I do remember that.
And they find these dummies, and then they try to escape in a boat, but it's all made of wood. Then they use that to their advantage to escape the Decepticons.
Do Spike and Carly not understand movie making? Just as Hoist doesn't understand food?
And then in the final bit of movie magic, Megatron walks into, I don't know, what is this, like a medieval dungeon set? It's the old hold the heroes over a pit of lava trope.
Flesh-eating lava.
Yeah, right. Yeah, why did they specifically call it flesh-eating?
I think lava is flesh-eating on itself.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Hoist threatens to drop Carly and Spike into the lava, and then he does, and that's enough to convince Megatron that the footage is destroyed and that, like, their mission's over, and they fly off.
The end.
Oh wait, we still got a minute left.
Yeah, well, they have to prove that it's not lava. It's muddy water with some air hoses to create the bubbles.
And some fog machines, yeah, for the smoke.
Hoist seems pretty excited by that.
Are the Transformers would they get killed in the lava? Are they fire? Are they heat resistant? It's never come up. We've never seen them dive into a volcano or get in a fire or anything.
Not yet.
Well, they can fully submerge in water. They can swim.
They can speak underwater.
They can ski. They can ride surfboards. So they have a lot of interaction with water. I think there was one where Optimus was over like a vat of acid. Like that was green, I think. But yeah, he.
I remember that. Yeah.
He avoided that. I think they would melt, I would say. Okay. Yeah, they would be susceptible to the heat.
Wasn't there one comic where there was this pool of lava and like this one,
yeah, the smelting robot pool,
yeah, that didn't, yes, have a name, and he like fell and they were all really sad because he was a really nice guy that didn't even have a name.
Scrounge, you mean?
Yes. I forgot his name, but he was really nice.
Wheeljack, the scientist, is shown that what the invention was that was stolen, and boy oh boy, it wasn't worth the whole episode.
It was useless. Yeah, it's just like the ultimate MacGuffin, because he's like, oh, I had that in my lab, I could never get it to work. So
if it had worked, then I would have taken it with us.
Yeah, which also means that the Decepticons went to Cybertron, which they can do, and then they stole this thing that never ever worked. So as far as, wow, plot devices to go, because, you know, usually Alex, like Megatron's building something to, you know, take all of the Earth's oil or drain all the power from the sun. He had a very Starkiller Base thing in season one. Yeah, but this one, he was stealing something that proved to do nothing. what is this episode about? What's it all for? Does the director offer him his job back? But then Hoist says no, he's got more important things to do.
He offers Hoist to be the leading man in his new movie, and then Hoist is just like, no, but actually my name is Hoist.
Yeah.
He's like, whatever. Okay.
Oh, and then it ends. The final shot, is that the layering mistake you were talking about, Emmett? Or like Sunstreaker looks like he crushes Spike and Carly. But the episode ends with all the Autobots back together. They say, we're with you. And we fade out. So, Alex, that is the end of Hoist Goes Hollywood. So,
wow.
For every episode, we give a ranking, 1 to 10 Energon cubes. And as our guest, you can go first. What did you think of Hoist Goes Hollywood?
I thought it was pretty weird. There was a show called Axe Cop years ago.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the premise of Axe Cop is that it was like an animated cartoon, but it was like written like by a 5-year-old.
Based on a comic. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But and that's kind of what this felt like to me. It's like, this is what a little kid imagines making a movie is like. There's no real logic behind it. And it's just kind of like, so I'll give this one a 7 out of 10.
Okay. Who wants to go next?
I'll go.
Okay.
I would say 7.5. It wasn't as good as I remember. I still enjoyed it, but it just felt a bit longer than it really needed to be. Like, hey, look at this, then this, then this, then this. So overall, 7.5. It was good.
Elsa, how about you?
7. I think it was good, although it was kind of long.
It felt long?
It did feel long.
I will go 8. I do like the movie making part of it. I do like the humor that they try to inject with kind of the running gag of the when they're filming it where the Autobots are crashing into stuff. I do like the Harold Edsel character, though he seems to have his heart set on being this being his star making vehicle, and he gets overshadowed by a giant transforming truck. It's kind of a letdown that the device did nothing, but also that's kind of funny. Again, we're very far into the season, and you know, the plots are getting weirder and weirder, and some work, some don't. But I think this one, for the most part, it works for me. But I can see how people would think this was maybe a dumb episode. One of 4 episodes pre-movie that do not feature Optimus Prime. So Alex, yeah, you didn't get to see the king of the Autobots. You saw as you put it, the king of the bad guys.
Yes, exactly.
not king of the good guys. So Alex, yeah, thank you for joining us. Do you have anything to plug? Anything coming up on the horizon, or any recommendations?
Well, plugs. I mean, our new season of Rise of Skywalker, Star Wars Minute, should be coming out in the next few weeks or so.
Okay.
So we'll see. And people, my website is alexrobinson.fun. There you can find links to my various podcasts, my merch store, etc., etc.
Your books?
Yep, all that there. That too.
I think that about wraps it up. So, everybody, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on an all-new One More Prime. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye.